Hi, it's Patrick here. And I wonder what you think of cities and streets and how we negotiate them, how we map out our destinations, how we reach them. Is there a kind of grammar at work? In the simplest terms, I guess, you could say there's point A, the subject noun, point B, the destination, the object noun. And the verb is, well, how we get there, on foot, by car, by subway. And then there are the adverbs and the adjectives that give order to our journey or slow us down. Things like traffic lights or passing lanes, street signs, speed bumps. I know that grand metaphor doesn't really hold up, but in most cities there is a system that, with some familiarization, we accustom ourselves to and we use communally. It may break down a lot because people don't always follow the rules, but there is a fundamental way of doing things, a grammar. So what if there's a grammar deficit, no verb to complete the sentence, to link the subject and the object? Well, you have that situation in a lot of places, like, for example, Dar es Salaam, the largest city in Tanzania. Here's the big show's Jeb Sharp outside an elementary school there.
It's dismissal time, and kids are spilling out of the school's gates right onto a four-lane highway. Many of them live in the neighborhood on the other side of the road, and there's no traffic light, no pedestrian crossing, no crossing guard.
So there's a young girl, maybe 10 years old, and she's on the central reservation, waiting to cross to her school. A huge truck with a 40-foot container going past, and there she goes. She runs across. She makes it.
Not everyone does. In a two-year period, 12 kids were hit on that stretch of highway. The problem is the highway itself has improved. It's been paved, so the cars and trucks go faster, and there's nothing to slow them down, no modifier, no shared grammar. Well, on the pod today, a consideration of the language of urban geography. As a country, an entire country, radically changes its street address system. Also, teaching English to native Portuguese speakers, a visit to a model school, and the story of a typist hired in the 1960s by that great surrealist, Frank Zappa.
He wanted me to take down the lyrics of Absolutely Free, his second album. Songs like The Duke of Prunes, Call Any Vegetable.
She was so thrown by the lyrics, she made up her own. The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program, The Big Show, are productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, The Big Show's at theworld.org. The podcast is at theworld.org/language. You can also find my blog posts at patrickcox.wordpress.com. I'm on Twitter. My handle is patrickcox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. And the pod has a page on Facebook called The World in Words. And today, on the podcast, we'll hear back from an anthropological linguist who went to live in Greenland for a year to study the local Inuit language and culture. Also, a school that's become a model for English language learning. The kid's first language is Portuguese. And the words of Frank Zappa, as understood, and often not very well understood, by a young English typist. First, though, the language of urban geography. I once spent 3 weeks reporting in South Korea. I remember a lot of that time was spent getting lost, or rather not finding the addresses of various people I had appointments with. This was before the days of personal GPSs. It wasn't just me. Taxi drivers and passers-by who I would call upon for help, they couldn't assist me either. I would eventually make it to my destination by calling up the person I was supposed to be meeting and having them explain to the taxi driver or the passerby exactly how to get there, and then I'd be led to that particular building. Never has so much time been wasted in the pursuit of radio journalism. Well, I am more than a little relieved to hear that this is a widespread and perennial problem in South Korea. It's all down to a somewhat eccentric street address system. It's been around for more than 100 years, but even after all of that time, people just don't understand it. It's so bad that the government has had enough and is doing something about it. Here's The Big Show's lost man in Seoul, Jason Strother.
Around lunchtime, calls start coming in to the Yonghuaru Chinese restaurant. Mr. Han takes orders over the phone for his takeout and delivery place. The delivery men check out street maps pinned up all over the wall before heading off on their motorbikes. Han says finding the customers can be pretty tricky, especially for new drivers. We start off by sending them to nearby places, really simple directions, he says. Once they get familiar with the area, then I send them farther away. Han says it's tough at first, but after a while, you memorize the addresses. Korea's address system is modeled on Japan's. It assigns addresses chronologically instead of geographically. In other words, buildings are numbered according to when they were built, not where they are located on a street. Directions here usually include a list of landmarks. Maps are often printed on the back of business cards. But this complex system will soon be a thing of the past. This commercial introduces viewers to Korea's new address system. The government says it'll make it easier and quicker to order takeout, send packages, and get help in case of an emergency. The new system is more like in the West, using a building's number, street name, and city. The government will permit dual usage of the old and new systems until December 2013. After that, the old system will be abandoned. Not everyone here is so pleased with the change. Some of the strongest opposition comes from Buddhists. Monks at Seoul's Joge Temple petitioned the government to hold off on the new system. I spoke with Togyung outside the temple. In our country, there are areas and roads that are closely related to Buddhism, he says. We're protesting because the new address system is renaming some of those places or getting rid of their names altogether. We feel like we're losing our heritage. He says the monks don't oppose the new system in general. They just want the streets and neighborhoods with Buddhist names to be left alone. Officials at South Korea's Ministry of Public Administration and Security, the agency in charge of the new addresses, declined to be interviewed. But a spokeswoman said that the ministry is still working out the kinks in the new system. Beyond the monks, many other Koreans aren't so sure if Western-style building numbers will make their lives any better, even those you might think would benefit from the new system. Yeon Il is the 70-year-old owner of a tea house located on a small alley in one of Seoul's busy tourist neighborhoods. She says she's glad to see the old system go, but she's also not yet convinced. She says, the old address system did make it hard for people to find my shop. They sometimes walked right by it. But there are so many small alleys in this neighborhood and all around the country. If people couldn't find what they were looking for under the old system, she says, they probably won't be able to find it now, no matter what numbers appear by the front door. For The World, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
Well, here's a place that's easier to find than it used to be. Northwestern Greenland. Okay, so it's not that easy, but it's far from impossible. For starters, Amazon delivers there, as we'll hear. It's up there in northwestern Greenland that linguist Stephen Leonard of Cambridge University spent the past year. He was studying the language and the hunter-gatherer culture of the Inuktitut, the polar Inuit. We ran an interview with Stephen Leonard before he spent his year there. That's in The World in Words number 100. And now, an exit interview. Leonard is back in the UK, and he hasn't exactly returned with good news. The BBC's John Humphreys asked him if the polar Inuit had been contaminated by the outside modern world. Here's Leonard's answer.
I was amazed and surprised and shocked at how rapidly their traditional culture has been replaced by what I think is a very unattractive, phony, synthetic monoculture of consumerism, which is driven by globalization and it's leveling cultures and languages right across the world, I think.
But how did it get to them, as it were?
Oh, via people like Amazon. this is the amazing thing. They still live in very simple wooden shacks, but they have many people have access to the internet, so they can order.
Oh, so they do have electricity and all that.
The vast majority have electricity, yes. Right. So they're able to order, you know, the latest Hollywoodian war videos via the internet and Amazon delivers. So.
But they do still have tradition. I mean, you've got some drumming. I think we can hear a bit of it, can't we? Let's just hear a little bit of their drumming.
Sure.
Yes, I mean, when you hear that, you think, well, yeah, that's an ancient culture at work there.
That's right. That's my dear friend Ayako Michik, who's a 67-year-old former hunter. He's one of the very few people left in the community that knows the pre-Christian traditional drum songs, what we call the bi'ek. But that form of entertainment and the storytelling, which is a means of transferring knowledge, that's very rapidly disappearing. And I'm afraid to say I think that would be gone in 10, 20 years' time. The problem with that is that, you know, if the sea ice disappears, then they'll be losing an awful lot of knowledge.
Because?
Because the knowledge is bound up in these stories, and the story's not being passed on to younger people.
Because they're leaving, are they, or what?
No, because they're not really interested. They're sitting around, they're playing video games, they're watching violent DVDs, and they've turned their back on their traditional culture. And that is an issue because what is interesting is that many of the polar Eskimos, the people I was living with, they don't actually believe in man-made climate change. So if in 25 years' time the weather changes again as they predict and the sea ice comes back, they would have lost that knowledge, and that could be potentially dangerous if you're hunting on the ice.
I'm not quite sure how I see the connection between the disappearance of the sea ice and the disappearance of their culture.
Well, they are people of the sea ice. That defines their culture. They travel on the sea ice. They are the last Inuit to travel by dog sledge. And if that goes, then they will lose a large part of their culture, which is, of course, the subsistence hunting.
But look, if they don't mind, why should we?
Well, you know, when we lose spoken traditions, when we lose a language, we lose an orchestra of voices that permeate the mind. We lose music, we lose poetry, and we lose the knowledge that's tied up in those stories, in those drum songs, and in that language. So it is very important that we preserve what we have.
That's a pretty grim message. It's not much of a comfort that during his year among the Polo Inuit, Leonard documented and archived the Inuktitut language. That's almost like a post-mortem of a language. Or whatever you call it, if a few dozen people were still speaking the language, a pre-mortem. Well, now on to another form of language death, and that's the successful effort in some U.S. states to ban bilingual education. California is the biggest and most significant such state where this has happened. Several other states have done it too, including here in Massachusetts, where voters passed Question 2, back in 2002. The main argument in favor of the ban was that it would force non-English-speaking kids to learn English as quickly as possible. The research doesn't always seem to suggest that that's how it turns out, that if you stop kids from speaking their own languages in the classroom and teach them just in English, that they'll pick up English faster. I mean, some of them will drop out altogether. But nonetheless, that was why a lot of people voted for it. So, in this third and final part of our series on the effects of this ban, we're going to take a look at a school that has as its central goal the teaching of English to non-native speakers. The reporter is WGBH's Andrea Smarden, and she's reporting out of Framingham, a town about 20 miles from Boston.
Woodrow Wilson Elementary in Framingham seems like your average all-American school, complete with the strains of Yankee Doodle coming from a first-grade class. But stick around, and you'll notice an unusual emphasis on the English language. In between songs, the teacher is inserting vocabulary lessons.
Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony, and I noticed these girls are showing me. Oh, I know, the word noticed, it came up.
There are words on the wall, like noticed, and anytime someone says one of the special words, they add a tally to it. Down the hall in fourth grade math class, the teacher seems to be unusually focused on the words in the math problem.
So this is about Nancy. And how tall is she?
8 inches.
She can't be 8 inches tall.
Taller than her.
Taller. Oh, okay. That is an ER over here. All the English in this headline story is about comparing. Look at my English words. Then, and the ER. Those are the English parts we have to pay attention to understand the math problem. So today,
this method of teaching is called sheltered English immersion. The idea is to teach English to children even while they're learning other subjects like math. and to present the subject in a way that an English language learner can understand. Most of these students are Portuguese speakers from Brazil, so the teacher tries to reference what they may already know.
And how hot is in our class?
64.
64 what?
Fahrenheit.
Okay, it's Fahrenheit, because in Brazil we actually would measure in
Celsius.
Very good. But we're in the United States, in New England, and we all use Fahrenheit. But
this method of teaching became the prevailing model after the passage of Question 2, and the Framingham schools have refined it. Michelle DaCosta is an ELL specialist for elementary programs for the district. She says teaching English has become a school-wide project.
One of the activities that we worked with second language learners is to increase vocabulary, and the school has chosen some words about character development, words like confidence and perseverance, and we do that as a full school, so you'll see displays around the building, and you'll see them done bilingually and with drawings.
DaCosta says just about everyone is involved with English language learners in some way. In a recent training she led for teachers on sheltered immersion, two gym teachers showed up.
They were there because they teach gym and they have students who are ELLs and they want to learn about everything that they can do to support the students. And they came up with vocabulary activities to, you know, reinforce the learning of a lot of those skills.
But this has not always been DaCosta's experience teaching new immigrants in Framingham. When she started as a teacher 18 years ago, she was all alone.
My job was to greet these recent arrivals, teach them everything I could about beginning English, teach them curriculum in Portuguese so that they wouldn't get behind. And I was really trying to do a one-man band.
DaCosta says she has to give Question 2 some credit for the change, as well as strong leadership from the district level. After the law, the district revised its programs and retrained its bilingual teachers.
We spent the whole summer in course and workshops, really thinking about our instruction. So we spent pretty much the whole month of July wrapping our heads around doing more of the integrated English language teaching within the content areas.
The State Education Department has looked to Framingham as a model for the way it's dealt with English language learners and the transition to English immersion. State Education Commissioner Mitchell Chester says there is a huge range of challenges when comparing districts, but he does see one critical factor for success.
We need to integrate our general education programs with our services for English language learners. And where English language learners are making the best progress are the places where that integration is happening most robustly.
Back in first grade, students are practicing for their end-of-year presentation. To the uninitiated, it may seem like a simple song and dance, but for the English immersion team at Wilson, it's considered oral language development. For 89.7 WGBH, I'm Andrea Smartin.
And now, a musician who's long overdue on the pod.
One, two, buckle my shoe.
Yep, Uncle Frank Zappa. In 1967, right around the time when Zappa was recording this and many other great songs, he had a chance encounter with someone called Pauline Butcher. He was in London on tour with his band, The Mothers of Invention. She was a secretary working for a London agency on short-term jobs. She was prim, a little naive, as she describes herself. She got the call from her agency to meet with Zappa to type up the lyrics of his new album. And these were no ordinary lyrics. These were, at the time, actually to this day, some of the strangest, darkest, funniest rock lyrics ever written. So, Butcher did that short job, and then she continued to work for Zappa. For years, she followed him back to Southern California, and now she's written a memoir, quite a sweet memoir, of the time that she spent around Frank Zappa. She spoke with BBC reporter Nicola Stanbridge about it.
Carrying her portable typewriter, Pauline Butcher arrived at Frank Zappa's London hotel room on an assignment in the summer of 1967. She would soon become part of his team.
Mr. America, walk on by your schools that do not teach. Mr. America, walk on by the minds that won't be reached.
Was shocked when he opened the door because of the way he looked, with these long ringlets hanging down, looking like Charles I, quite convinced I'd come to the wrong room, and he's a Pauline butcher. He wanted me to take down the lyrics of Absolutely Free, his second album. Songs like The Duke of Prunes, Call Any Vegetable.
This is a song about vegetables. They keep you regular. They're real good for you.
I couldn't understand the lyrics, and so some of them, I just made them up. And when he read them through, he just chuckled. And he said, well, you should write your own songs on this basis. And I said, well, if I did, I would make them less rude. He was quite chuffed by this. He seemed to enjoy the argument.
Living with the family in various hangars, honours at Laurel Canyon in California with Frank Zappa, what were his days like as a serious musician? What was he like at work?
During the period I was there, he was much more into instrumental music. He wrote Hot Rats. He worked mostly at night, get up, maybe about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, go to his grand piano he had in the corner, tinkle around with that, sometimes switch to a guitar. He would write it all down beautifully on these A3 sheets of music, get Ian Underwood, who was one of the people in his band, to come over and play it with both hands, which he himself could not do. All this beautiful music would ring out. It's quite astonishing.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Fellow Americans.
Was he as serious about his intentions to become president as well in 1976, do you think?
Yes, he was serious. Didn't do it in 1976 because he was sidetracked with still developing his music. But by 1988, when he finally put his guitar away, that was the time when he seriously decided he was going to run for president. It was in the back of his mind all his life. When he became ill with prostate cancer, that in fact debilitated him for the last 4 years of his life. He did continue to do tours in Europe and see his classical music played.
Were you able to attend his funeral?
No, that's really a very sore area. Only the four children and Gail were there, not his mother, not his brothers or sisters or anyone. I actually think that was shocking. I have the fondest, dearest, kindest memories. He was such a humane and kind man. Unusual, he was very, very intelligent. He was so charismatic. I just felt privileged to have that time working with him.
That's it for this week. You can contact me via Twitter or Facebook or at theworld.org/language or email me. The address is language@pri.org. See you next week.
America's wonderful. Wonderful, 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 wonderful. It really makes it.